I gave you a double dose because I forgot to turn it off on on Friday, so it was actually two classes all in one. And I'm sure I could edit it. I don't know quite how to do that, so I'm not that skilled.
If you wanted something, I could help you with that.
Oh, really? Oh, I might I might take you up on that.
Yeah,
I have no clue.
If you send me the file, I could cut it for you.
Really?
It's a pretty simple process.
Okay, yeah. What program?
I use.
Are you on PC or Mac?
So I'm a PC guy.
Okay.
But if you have Mac, GarageBand works great.
What's it called?
GarageBand.
Oh, I've got GarageBand. Yeah, I've never figured it out though.
You copy the file into the. If you wanted to bring your computer sometime, I can take.
Okay.
5 minutes.
Would you just put a tape head there or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's all it is.
Okay.
It takes about 3 seconds.
Okay, I may do that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
How do you know Jeremiah?
That's nice of you.
I mean, they weren't very good.
I used to play around with Garage.
All right, good morning, everybody. Welcome. Hope you guys all enjoyed your first weekend, right? All these great new things you get to handle. And what about this just beautiful humidity? Isn't it just great? I spent the summer in Colorado, so this is a little oppressive, but such is life. Okay, we're going to do something a little bit different today than what I've done normally. So we're right on chapter 2, and obviously we're going to have to go a little bit faster because we have to get through the Jews. If we did this, we'd still be on, I don't know, Genesis 17 or something in a month, and we can't obviously go that slowly. But I want to start by looking at the last of your readings that I gave you for today. So no new readings for Wednesday, right? Everything that I've assigned you, just make sure you've read those. So nothing to read extra, that is, between today and Wednesday. Just make sure you're all caught up and read through. I think I had assigned the first two readings from the Greeks, right? So just make sure you're on that. Today, I don't know if we'll get through all the Hebrews, but we're going to try. So I want to... Yes.
You assigned Herodotus and the funeral oration.
Right.
You didn't assign that first one where it's like that code.
The Code of Hammurabi, right? I never assigned that.
Okay.
Yeah. So don't
I just
have to worry
to make sure
about
I had
that.
Part of
nope. You're fine. Totally fine. Good. Thanks, Kenneth. Okay. So I want to turn to this discussion, which is a great discussion that we have between God and Samuel. So she wasn't there.
She wasn't there.
Oh, no. Oh, because it's Labor Day.
Right.
Sorry. Would you mind just sharing books for today? That'd be great. Thank you. So, thank you.
So positive.
Okay, so just turn to page 29 of your reader. And we had this really nice debate, interesting debate, discussion, I guess, maybe we could call it, between Samuel and God. And it's a discussion here about the nature of politics and what kind of ruler should we have. These are timeless questions, of course. And for those of you who had a chance to read Herodotus, you saw here you have those Persians called the Melian Dialogue. They're already discussing this question. What's the best ruler? Do we want a monarch? Do we want an aristocracy? Do we want a democracy? We're going to see that ad nauseum this semester. That is deeply rooted in the Western tradition. This idea of three, and I'll talk more about three, but not today. Because what we see here is an interesting argument in favor of kingship that God rejects at first. And that's fascinating in and of itself, that he's rejecting that. So there are two things to keep in mind as we start this piece. Number one, and we haven't done much with this, but just a little bit. Imagine how the character of God changes from what we read 20 pages earlier to now. So when we first see God, he is ordered, he is creative, he is sovereign in every way, and then he creates men and women in his image. So we know that men and women have this kind of stewardship. Now, we didn't get to chapter 2 yet. We'll do that hopefully in a bit. But when we get to chapter 2, we'll see that God's not just their sovereign, he's also their companion. So he walks with Adam. Right? He's in the forest. In the garden. They're talking to one another. And then we get to Abraham. Abraham's joking with him. Right? Abraham, when God says, Sarah's going to have 99, or she's going to have so many kids, and she's 99. Abraham actually falls down on the ground laughing at God. Are you kidding me? I mean, think about that relationship that they have there. It's very tight. Then we get to Moses. And with Moses, we have this God is in the burning bush through the voice of an angel. He's that distant. But now we come back just a little bit where Samuel is talking to God. It's not face to face, we don't presume. but they're talking to one another. So that relationship that we see, the character of God, is changing pretty dramatically, or at least he's not changing, but we're changing in relationship to him. And, yeah.
I thought that when Abraham left, it was a lack of faith. Like, he was saying that, I never interpreted it as, like, he was joking with God.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when Sarah had the lack of faith that God would
have
her child.
Look, you're right. I probably shouldn't have put it quite that way. Let's put it this way. If God told you to do something, would you laugh at him?
No.
Yeah, most likely not, right? We'd be just, I mean, mesmerized, horrified, terrified, right, to have that kind of face in front of us. But Abraham's still close enough that he can actually do that, right? That's all I'm getting at. You're right. It's the lack of faith. Absolutely. But the fact that he can respond in that way tells us something. And he's still, obviously, he's a good guy and he's an ally, right? God doesn't punish him for laughing at him, right? It's okay, yeah. Abraham. So, yeah, I hope that makes sense. I should have been a little clearer about the way I said that. So thank you for that. Soren.
I don't think I'm completely understanding. Is God, is our relationship, or how we relate to God, is it changing where we're drifting away from him or that we're moving towards him? I don't see the change that's happening.
Right. So the, what we see over, so on page, by the time we get to page 29, and especially by the time we're going to get to David, we're just seeing the gap. So our relationship in the beginning with God is not equal, but it's friendship, certainly. Great, very close friendship. An intimate friendship. But we're definitely moving away from him as things happen. And, of course, you only have the first three chapters of Genesis, and then we jump to, what, 17? But if you read the 50 chapters of Genesis, you've got the one chapter that's really good. And then everything else is this kind of horror show. And it really is this kind of litany of just blood and redemption, blood and forgiveness, where we just keep, humans keep screwing up, and God keeps forgiving over and over again. But as we do, we keep getting farther away from him. He keeps trying to pull us back, but we get farther and farther away. So all I'm suggesting here is that the relationship is in some way widening, in a way that, and this is why, I mean, from a Christian perspective, there would be almost no alternative to God taking physical form. That is the most intimate thing you can possibly imagine. It can't get more intimate. Right? He resides in a woman's womb for 9 months. It just doesn't get any more intimate than that. So that also shows that distance and what it's going to have to take to bring things back from a Christian perspective. Does that help, Soren?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, no, thank you. It's great. Lionel.
I was just going to say, it's that you're talking about the one person in Scripture who is known as the friend of God. It's the only person in Scripture known that way.
Who's that?
Abraham.
Oh, yeah.
You see this decline throughout the rest of the Old Testament.
Right.
All the way through to the kings and past.
Absolutely. Right? It just never really ends. It just keeps getting wider and wider in every way. Yeah, that's great. Okay, so somebody want to read this paragraph here? Actually, two paragraphs. We'll start at verse 7. We're on page 29. So, what's your name?
Shelby.
Shelby, that's right. Thank you. So, just start, and the Lord said to Samuel.
And the Lord said to Samuel, "Hearken to the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Now then, hearken to their voice, only you shall solemnly warn them, and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them." So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking a king from him. He said, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots, and to be his horsemen, and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest, and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day."
Okay, and then the people refused to listen. Right, so, very nicely read, Shelby. So this is important in the sense that we have God who's still, at least in the story, I'm sure we can have a lot of different theological interpretations about this, but in the story, he's still negotiating. He's still willing to give and take with humanity, at least with the Jews, right, with his chosen people. And that's pretty stunning in and of itself. So it basically says, look, if you get a king, everything's going to go wrong in the sense that you're going to lose your sons, you're going to lose your sustenance, you're going to be taxed, all of these things, right? So why do you want this, and why? I've done everything possible to make you a unique people. Why do you want to be like everybody else? So I mentioned to you a little bit ago that there have to be two things we have to understand as we get into kingship. Number one, I already mentioned, and that is we've got the gap is widening. But number two, assuming that, if God starts out as friend, right, or at least companion in the beginning, what does he appear now as to the people of Israel? What's his role? Yeah, he's a king. He's a monarch. So we find this as a very important lesson that we'll see throughout all of history. And that is, I don't want to say this always happens, and it actually only works in the Judeo-Christian world. It does not work in the Islamic world, which I can't quite explain, but it doesn't. And that is, almost always the way we see God is the way we tend to govern ourselves. We often reflect. So if we think of God as a king, we often want a king. If we think of God as a court, then we want an aristocracy. Or if we think of God as kind of spreading his grace through all the people equally, we want a democracy. So it's no accident that when we're looking at the medieval period, God is a king. And Jesus is essentially, he's king as well. But they have this whole court, there's this kind of big hierarchy that you have to go to. By the time you get to Calvin, very important, we'll end the semester around the time of Calvin. By the time we get to the Reformation and Calvin, Calvin's a Republican, small r Republican. He believes in a republic. And so what does God become? God becomes a judge, a Republican. And that always works that way. So it's a catch-22. It's not a one and the other. They both work in some way. So if we're democratic, we think of God as democratic. If we think of God as democratic, we think of ourselves as democratic. So we tend to do that all throughout history. Now, that's only in the Judeo-Christian world. I don't know why that doesn't work in Islam as well. But it is definitely true, at least as a general rule, it's true in the Western world.
I can see how that does work in the Western world. How have you normally seen it so that you can say clearly this does not work in, like, nations that practice Islam? How is it obvious that that theorem cannot be?
Because partly it's because Islam has had such a different kind of history, right? Starting in the 600s, it's an imperial phase. It had, we'll talk about it when we get to Islam, but the way that it grows, it breaks into three immediately. Okay, so you have Muhammad, and then you have the three who break into the various branches of Islam. They're more, the gap between those branches, for example, is much, much greater than the gap between Catholics and Protestants. It's much greater. So, the way that they, for how they project what the law will be, there's a number of different things in how they see themselves. So the Iranians are very different in their practice than the Afghanis, or at least parts of the Afghanis, but the Afghanis are at war, obviously. They've been at war with each other forever. So there's that kind of civil war that's embodied in all that. But we will, I promise, we'll get to that. Not in depth, but we will get to that. We'll talk about it, especially when we get to the Middle Ages. So, good. Anything else on this? Okay, yeah, so...
How would the American... I'm not seeing the connection between how the American culture, and I'm thinking founding fathers,
sure,
saw God.
And they saw him as a Republican.
What's that?
They saw him as a Republican.
What is that? How does that play out, though? Is that like he set laws, and then the laws is what rules?
Partly. I mean, it's more complicated than that. And the founders, they have a very... So it's not... We'll get to them in a... We will talk about the founders, believe it or not, in the next few days. But they see themselves as much more Roman than they do as Greek or Hebrew. But they still have the Hebrew language. And the founders are obsessed with Hebrew, thinking that because it's the language of creation, it has a power to it that no other language would have. So we'll see how they're influenced. But they do have, in general, that kind of Presbyterian Christianity that rules in America during the founding is very Republican.
And when you say Republican, judge would be another way of saying that.
Not necessarily. I mean, actually believing in a republic,
okay,
believing that a republic is the best way to rule. Okay. Not the same thing as a democracy.
I don't see God's rule in the republic, I guess, is what I'm missing.
God is all three things. God the Father is the executive. God the Son is the aristocracy. God the Holy Spirit is democracy.
Okay. Yeah. That makes more sense.
Yeah. So, but I promise we'll get into all this. Promise. You guys will be sick of it by the end of the semester. So hopefully not. Hopefully you'll love it. Okay. So, just keep this in mind that, okay, God is willing to negotiate. But he also lays out in the way that any of you who are libertarian, your soul should soar when you read God's arguments against monarchy. It's like, yeah, here it is, right here. This is what we don't want. And yet, it's what the Jews demand. And so, we get two rulers. And neither of them works out very well in terms of how they show their morality. Now, again, a couple of things here that are going to be important. Remember, both Saul and David, as you read, and I told you guys to read this quickly because it's so long and there are really only a few things for this course. Obviously, for Scripture, it's all important. But for this course, there are really only two things that you need to get out of this. One, the Jews demand this. But they demand it in the sense because they think that a king, partially at least, will reflect the goodness of God. And these people are chosen by God, Saul and then David. Saul obviously goes off into the wackiest world possible. And we don't even have this in here because it's so disturbing. We didn't include this in your reading. But for those of you who've read all of this book and see what happens to Samuel, he's even trying to commune with the dead towards the end of his, and he's calling up a witch. I mean, it's just crazy stuff. I mean, it's pagan, as you can imagine, that he's doing. But then we get to David, and we see what happens with the house of David. David walks out onto his rooftop, and he sees the beautiful form of a woman, and he wants her, even though he has no right whatsoever, first of all, to think of her as his property. He also has no right to take her because she is already in the house of Uriah. This is Bathsheba. And he not only lusts and sleeps with her, but he sends her husband to the front lines to die. Uriah's heap, right, on the front lines. So this is even when we see God's chosen. This can go bad very, very quickly. Now, I bring this up. I'm not trying to pass judgment on David. I have my own sins, and not those sins, but I have my own sins. And I'm sure we all do, right? But you think about what happens with David, and I bring this up now in part because of your question, Soren, later, but not quite the founders. When we get to Christianity, and I would like you guys to write this down for now, but we're not going to talk about it quite yet, but you've got to keep it in the back of your head. David is a completely mixed blessing. So when you go forward, and this will make more sense at the end of next week probably, but if you're a Christian missionary, let's just put ourselves in 200 AD and we're in Rome, and of course we're persecuted, but let's say we're trying to evangelize. There are no Jews around anymore. But the Jews have all been moved out of the area since 70 AD. So the idea we think of Jews converting to Christianity, that happens for about 20 years, and barely, and then it never happens really again. Now, all the people who come into Christianity are going to be, in some way, non-Judeo-Christians. But that means all of the Romans, they are generally what was called Stoic. They were a form of religion that worshipped their ancestors. And they loved, one of their greatest heroes was Socrates. And as we'll see when we read Socrates, Socrates not only teaches turn the other cheek, but he also dies for his beliefs. He's a great martyr. He never succumbs. So if I were a Christian missionary, and I went up to you to preach Christ. Well, Christ makes sense. If you're a Stoic, Christ actually makes perfect sense in every way. It's like, oh yeah, he's the Logos, that makes sense. But your heroes, when we look back, you've got this guy David. It was the greatest stumbling block for the first 400 years of the Christian church. The story of David. Stoics could not get over that. Like, how dare you worship this guy? Yeah, or how dare you put him up in your pantheon? If we have Socrates, who was a pagan, and he never, ever betrayed anybody. Right? He lived true. And so this was a great, something Christians had to really deal with. How do you tell the story of David and yet still promote the whole Judeo-Christian story? It's very, very difficult. And we'll see that a number of Christians respond, and this is heresy, but a number of Christians respond by just ignoring the Old Testament. They just say, well, we're something totally different. We're not really Jews at all. And that's not true, and it's a heresy, but they do that. That's one way they can get rid of David. So I want you to keep that in mind. David is a thorn, but he's also an example of goodness, and that's where it gets really hard. So when Queen Elizabeth passes away, and whoever takes her, is it going to be Harry? I can't remember who's, I don't keep up on the monarchy. Who's going to take over? Would it be Charles? I thought they were going to skip him. Okay, well, let's say they go to Charles. The ritual that they do, I mean, the actual kinging, that's not a word.
Coronation,
thank you. Kinging. I'm going to have to write that down. All right, so the actual coronation event is all based on the crowning of David. So every European monarch, everyone from Charlemagne all the way to today, whether it's the Danish king or the English king, all of them are based on what we see in the book that you just read for today. Right? That's all in the story of David. So even for those of you, I told you I'd bring up the Lord of the Rings a couple of times, for those of you who've read the Lord of the Rings, even the coronation of Aragorn is done exactly according to David. Right? You've got the priest, Frodo, you've got the prophet, Gandalf, and so they're the ones who give to Aragorn the king, the three offices of Christ. So those are all going to play a role. So just keep that in mind. So we don't need to talk much more about David. I just want you to know he's a very problematic figure because of what he does for conversions later on. It's going to be a very tough thing. And yet he is the ultimate monarch. So there's always that really kind of strange tension there. Yeah.
How did coronations take place then before David? Like what was tradition?
Well, it just depended. Remember, most kings that existed only in the pagan world. So usually you had god kings, and they would basically deify themselves. So you have the great god king of Persia, Xerxes. And what does he do? Well, I'm not just your king, I'm your god, too. So there's no separation of god and king. They become part of the pantheon in that way. So the idea of the Jewish coronation is very much, and we're getting into judges and republicans and so forth, it is a kind of division of powers. And David may have the blessing of God. God may be upon him, but he's not God. Right? That's very important, too. So tell me your name again.
Carly,
that's right. Yeah. I will get these down, promise. So, okay. So just keep that in mind for how we think about these things. All right. So any questions on that? And I apologize if I'm dropping hints where we're going, but we are going in certain directions. And there are certain things I do want to bring out because of how they will affect future events. Lauren?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Did the judges happen before the coronation of Saul?
Yes. Yeah, the Jews were ruled by judges prior to that. And they've had a bunch of different forms of rulership, but the judges were the main. And the judges still maintain a lot of power after the kingship, but not the power that they had before that. So, but they definitely have power. They're interesting, too. It's a fascinating story. Go ahead, Lauren.
And yeah. Are they chosen by God, too, or by the people?
Well, there are various ways that that's done. Traditionally, of course, it's God's will, right, the way that it's played out. So, yeah, sorry.
Quick question. Then, is there any other civilization that existed for anywhere close to the amount of time that the Jews existed without in a theocracy? Because reading this, I'm a little bit
almost
surprised that they would have existed so long,
yeah,
under just the rule of, under just a set of religious beliefs, if that makes sense.
Well, that's this is a question I can't answer, Soren, but it's one that as a liberal arts student, you and me both, we've got to think about. What really holds us together? What makes a people a people? And I think one of the things we learned from the Jews, at least, is it's not a constitution. It is a belief in a higher being. So I personally agree with that. But we'd have, if Dr. Arne were in here, we'd have a debate about this. Dr. Arne tends to think that constitutions hold people together. And I understand that. I mean, I don't totally disagree with him. I just tend to think constitutions work when they reflect a body of beliefs that the whole people share. And I don't want to put words in his mouth because he probably wouldn't have put it that way. But there's no doubt that we're trying to ask a question, and that is, what holds us together? Is it religion and culture? Or is it politics, economics, those kinds of things? I don't have an answer. I have a suspicion, but I don't have an answer to that at all. It's a great question. Kenna?
I was going to say, would the judges, like, before, they were kind of like the servant rulers, sort of. and like judging the people to try to keep them in line, mm-hmm. to keep them tied together as a people. But then after the kings were put into place, did they kind of take on more a role of an advisor and less a judge? Because like Samuel, he does tell David God's judgment,
but
absolutely. He doesn't quite have the same kind of authority he would have had before David was crowned.
If you don't mind, I'm going to put that into Christian terms rather than Jewish terms, just because of where we're going. So the whole relationship, I'm actually very glad you brought this up, because I should have brought it up and I didn't, and I was ready to move on without saying it. You guys need to know this. So the whole relationship of Nathan to David, that relationship, when Nathan goes and says to David, gosh, I'm so glad you brought this up, because if I had skipped this, it would be terrible. All right, that whole relationship is the relationship of church to politics. So, and that would be the Western tradition. So most of the Western tradition has been, and I guess this probably gets to your question too, Soren, about theocracies. Most of the Western tradition has had the church independent of politics. Now, we all know examples where that didn't happen. We know examples where in the West, the church and the political bodies were one. But that's actually very rare to have that. For the most part, the church is in opposition to the state, and the state is in opposition to the church. So Nathan and David becomes the role model. Here's where, and I'm not just putting this into specifically Christian, but into Western Catholic terms as well. This would be Nathan would be Pope, and David would be Emperor in the medieval system. So that's the relationship there. Nathan serves as Pope, right? Pope just means Papa, the big father. Right? So, yeah. Yes, Shelby. I'm sorry. Lionel, did you have your hand? Who had your hand? You had your hand up.
He answered it.
Oh. I was asking him anyways. Thanks. All right.
Is Nathan the one that tells the story about, like, the sheep?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Remember VeggieTales?
Yeah. That's actually why I
of course, that's
it.
Why everybody your age knows this.
I actually never seen
that. Oh, yeah.
I know VeggieTales, but...
All right, good. So that's really important. So keep that in mind. We're going to keep coming back to that theme over and over again. Carly.
Do you think that relationship between church and state exists now? And if so, like,
no.
What way do we fix it?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. Yeah. Right? So in Western Christianity, Protestant and Catholic, there's always been this view that the church has a power over the state, that the state does not have the power over the church. That is, the church has no weapons, but it can deny religious communion with God of political rulers who are misbehaving. We're going to, especially in about 4 weeks, we're going to talk a lot about this when we get to the early Christian church. So the church doesn't have a way of condemning politics in any kind of physical way. It can only deny them. So, we'll get into the kind of crazy stuff here, but I hope one of the things you guys, I hope you all know, you have to know this when we get especially into the Christian church itself. The role of priest, there's nothing wrong with the term priest, right? All priest means is bridge. So it's the same word, if any of you are Presbyterians. Presbyterian is just a variation of priest, same word. Presbyter, priest, same word. So a priest is the bridge. And the bridge is always, in Rome, you literally have the bridge from the palace to the temple. I mean, literally there is a bridge that you would go from the palace to the temple to worship the gods. The priest is the in-between. So Nathan is the priest in that story, right? Gandalf, Frodo's the priest in Lord of the Rings. Gandalf's the prophet. But there's a relationship there, right? And in that idea, so you can't, the Pope or the head of the Christian church wouldn't say, wrestle to death Stalin, but he could deny Stalin communion. And that's really important. And this is going on now with the whole pro-life issue. You know, does a local, of course, the church is so messed up at the moment, but does a bishop have a right to stop, say, Nancy Pelosi from taking communion if she espouses things that are not in, that's the tradition. That's only, what else is the bishop, they're going to go gun her down? Of course not, right? Here, his only option is to deny, that's all he can do, is deny her the sacraments. And that doesn't mean she goes to hell. It just means she's not sanctified in the same level, right, from the teaching. So that's a really important thing. And I bring up Stalin, by the way, because when one of the good popes, Pope Pius, when he condemned Stalin, and Stalin said, well, that's fine. How many troops does he have? right? And that's the great response. I mean, it's a terrible response, but it's the response leaders give. Okay, fine, we'll just go mow them down. And leaders do that all the time. And that's the tradition is the religious guy condemns you and you go kill him. That just happens all the time. You think about prophets. Nobody liked Ezekiel. Nobody likes Jeremiah until he's dead. Then you love him. Nobody likes a prophet when they're alive. I mean, think of what's Jeremiah do? He walks around and tells everybody, you're just a whore. You've prostituted yourself. You're just, I mean, who's going to like that guy? And yet, it doesn't mean he's not totally right. But that's the problem. Politicians and rulers don't like that stuff. Yeah, understandably. So, I'm sorry, we had some other hands. Okay.
Yeah. This one's kind of like tied back to just, this has nothing to do with like the lesson, but like, will we, because we've already skipped one of the passages, will we touch on that section? It's like later in the Heritage Reader, where it's like the popes, there's a bunch of them, and they're like excommunicating each other.
We will like, too, yeah, we'll look okay. at that. It's
because I remember sitting in on that class when I toured, yeah, like interviewing, nice. And I was like, oh my yeah. goodness, I need this.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that's there's always, the whole Christian church, whatever you want to call it, right? It always has ups and downs, and obviously we're in a down period right now, but it's you always have this kind of corruption and reform. It happens all the time.
Okay.
Yeah. So in the long run, over the long run, yeah, you just kind of pray that you get through the corruption. So, yeah, Shelby.
Tying back to the stuff about coronations,
sure.
I would, and just how, like, God gives his blessing to, like, the king, supposedly, you know, like, God's blessing David
oh, yeah.
is in God.
Yeah, the Spirit of God is upon him.
Right.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if that's tied, because, like, in Herodotus' speech,
good.
He, when they're talking about monarchs on page 68, he talks about, like, how he doesn't want democracy because, like, he says, nothing is so void of understanding, so full of wantonness as the unwieldy rabble. And then he says, like, any knowledge in the rebel, like, there's no knowledge, it's untaught, with no natural sense of what is right and fit. So clearly he thinks that a monarch does have a natural sense of what is right and fit.
He
and
does
he think that's because of, like, a blessing from God, or because it's, like, good breeding?
Yeah.
Or education?
Yeah, if you don't mind, let's hold off on that.
Because
when we get to Herodotus specifically, we can talk about that.
Okay.
The Greeks are going to have a very different view, but remember, you're reading a Greek writing about
right.
the Persians. And the Greeks don't believe in kings like that. The Persians do.
So, okay.
Generally.
So is the person who's suggesting this Persian?
Yeah.
Is that what's it called?
Those are all Persians.
Okay.
That's the Melian dialogue. It's taking place with a bunch of Persians. But we'll get to that.
Okay.
So sorry. Just, no, it's great. I'm glad you're making those connections. But do hold off on that. And we'll get to that. Definitely bring that up on Wednesday.
Okay.
Okay. Good. So let me just jump back then. So we think about kingship. What's the relationship? So two terms that I want you to know in addition to what we've already talked about, but two very important terms for an understanding of the relationship of God to his people. And these are critical for Judaism in particular. We can't talk about the ancient Hebrew people without talking about these things. So when we were here last week, we talked about creation and everything that goes with that, the creator. We talked about how sovereign God is, the role that man has in terms of being a steward, right? We looked at that. We need to look at it a little more, but we looked at that. So the creation, it's good. It's very good. And so God as creator. But then we're going to get to the fall. And everything, of course, all of history takes place after the fall. So Adam and Eve are kicked out of the garden. Everything goes wrong. Just everything goes to hell. And so we've got this whole history where the whole history is the history of the fall. And it shouldn't surprise us when we see corruption around us. It always does. We're disappointed, we're hurt, but of course, my gosh, this has been going on since day one. This is what we do. So we also do great things, no question about that, but we do horrible things. So God continues every time we get farther away from him. He tries to pull us back. Right? That's the story, at least. And how does he do that? Two ways. Number one, he creates with us covenants. And a term you guys absolutely have to know in here. He creates covenants with us. Now, what is that? You guys all read this. You've got the Abrahamic covenant. And feel free to get a little PG-13 about this, but you kind of have to. What happens with the covenant? Lionel?
It
it's a binding promise. It's the closest you had to a legal system.
Okay, so what's if you and I shook hands right now and said, yeah, we agree that whatever, when you take your test, I'm going to give you 10 extra minutes because you need it. Just making this up. We shake hands. Is that a covenant?
In a sense, yeah.
Okay, how would it not be? What would it need to be for us to make it absolutely a covenant? What would we do?
At that point, I think you need some sort of blood oath.
Okay. Let's not do that.
But something, actually, we could do that. We could have a physical sign. That's fine. But who else needs to be there?
Oh, you need a witness.
Yes. Who stands for? God. Absolutely. So a covenant is a legally binding agreement with God involved. That's what a covenant is. So there are always three parties in a covenant. You, me, God. Right? And there's got to be something that keeps it that way. And that's why Abraham makes the covenant with God, but the third party are the Jews, right? All of his descendants. So you mentioned blood. Of course, what's the symbol here that's used? What is the Abrahamic covenant defined by?
Circumcision.
Yeah, circumcision. Right? So here we have circumcision. Now, who's that going to affect? Directly. Only the males. Now, this is fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. So only the male line is affected. But think about why it's there. Why not cut off an earlobe? Would that be just as, why not? I mean, that's just, if I cut off every male in here, we showed our love for God by cutting off our earlobe, or we pierced our nostril, or why not? Right? Why not remove a digit? You know, why circumcision?
Is it because it like relates more intimately to the women?
It does, absolutely. Who would see it?
Right.
Only your wife, right? Your mother and father and family, and then your wife. So it is a deeply, deeply personal thing. It's related to creation, right? Isn't that the symbol of procreation there? So it's this familial thing that affects men directly, but also women. Now, here's the crazy part. I'll get you in just a second. Here's the crazy part. Jews typically are what with their families? So if your mother's Jewish, what does Israel regard you as today? You're Jewish. So all of your descent is through the mother's line in terms of religion, but your house is through your father's line. That gets really complicated. That's also why Jesus has to be of the house of both Mary and Joseph, because I mean, it has to be the way that those bridge, and we get into that later. But it's very important. So within the house itself, so our rulership politically is through the male line, but our culture and custom is through the females in Judaism. That's wild to think about that. So to this day, now, I have a Jewish mother, I can go to Israel and be a citizen because I have a Jewish mother, right? If that, I don't actually, but if I did, right, that would be. So those are interesting in the way that that develops through that. Yeah,
but Leo. If you had a Jewish father, then you would not.
Father means nothing.
Really?
If I had a Jewish father, that does not make me Jewish. Only the mother. And of course, I don't have to be raised. You know, I mean, obviously, I could be raised anything, but by tradition.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. So, Leo, this is actually the same in the Catholic Church. If your mother's Catholic, you're automatically regarded as Catholic. Doesn't matter what your father is. So, for those of you who aren't Catholic, you're all thinking, wait a minute, that's not fair. But that's they use the same tradition. So, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. You had your hand up earlier, Carly.
No, that's fine. I was wondering, is it potentially circumcision is a sign of the covenant because God promised in Genesis that redemption would be through Adam's seed?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is all that intimate, procreative, and it is deeply intimate. Right? This is not an outward sign that everybody will know. So this is very personal. Deeply personal. Baby's a few days old, right? Everybody sees it. Nobody sees it again until marriage, right? That's the custom. So, yeah, very important to have that. Yeah. Okay. Now, that's going to be a really big problem later when the Greeks take over, because the Greeks think circumcision is just bizarre. And it's going to cause, I mean, they'll go to war over it. So that's where Judah Maccabees, that's where Hanukkah comes from. But we'll get to all that. later on. It's a big deal. But just keep that in mind. So that's the covenant. Now, there's not just one covenant. Right? God makes multiple covenants. There's the covenant with Noah, which I don't think you guys don't have in your readings, right?
No.
There's the covenant with Noah. So the covenant is not... A covenant is a one-time continuous process, but there doesn't have to be exclusively one covenant. My marriage, and my wife and I got married in a little Lutheran church 20 years ago this summer in Texas. It doesn't matter. Because we brought God into it, it's a covenant. It's recognized. So those kinds of things, by saying that, interestingly enough now, when you go into a courtroom, do you have to swear on a Bible?
You used to.
I don't have to do it anymore. But that was always, because it was, even if you were an atheist, you swore on the Bible. Because people wouldn't trust you. If you're not willing to speak the truth to the invisible God, who's there but not there, why would I trust you as a fellow citizen? Right? When you go in and testify, you promise that even if I get away with lying to Lauren, I'm not going to get away with it in eternity. I just condemned myself by lying. So I've taken an oath, and I've lied. Yeah, it's horrible. It's wretched. It's not unforgivable, but it's wretched. So, okay, anybody else? Hands up. I thought I saw a couple.
I had one, but it was kind of just like, was it house and rulership through the male line and religion, and what was the other thing? Through the
culture. Right, so culture, and that's why it's also really important, again, not yet, but this is why Mary matters, too, right, when we get to the story of Mary, why she has to be a certain thing from a certain house and respond in a certain way.
Is that why Rahab was also significant?
Partially. You'll see that throughout. Yeah, there are always kind of indications of that.
Okay.
All right, so the second thing that I want you to know, so covenant, a critical term. Guys, everybody, if I ask you covenant to define covenant, it's an agreement between man and God that is one time, but forever after that. Right? You can't break the covenant. Now, that's not the same thing as a contract. It's not the same thing as a compact, but they're related. Obviously, there's a continuation of one to the other. Contract would just be Lionel and I agreeing to exchange property or something, right? And you could still bring God into it, but it's a matter of just mere transference. It's different than my wife and I getting married, bringing children into the world, making a promise with one another. So tell me your name again.
Bryson,
thank you.
Does God have to initiate that covenant?
No. No, he has to agree to it, obviously, and he's the cement. But there's nothing for... I didn't hear anything from God when I got married. He didn't say, Brad, you and Deidre are now. I didn't hear that, but I assumed through the minister it was that. And the act itself, that he was blessing it in some way.
So you mentioned there's no breaking of the covenant. Most of the covenants I remember of God making with Abraham, even prior to the circumcision, was...
They're broken
all the time. Everything. Like they're broken by mankind. But
yes.
As the promise is made in a normal covenant, both people would walk between the animals,
yes.
But only God walked through. So he made a point that saying, the only person who can break it is me, and I won't.
Right. And he never does. Right. But humans do all the time. And we can't. Here's the thing, and it's hard to explain, at least for me. But it's not. The covenant can't be broken, but we ignore and mock it all the time. Right? We forget it, we ignore it, we mock it, we do things against it, but it still exists. It's just not, we're just not following through on it. And that's part of why God keeps making new ones and keeps trying to bring people back. So there's a second thing I'll put up here that God uses to keep people together. So, Lauren.
Can you explain the witness part of the covenant?
Sure.
Do they have to be present when it's being made or just know about it?
Yeah, it's generally you bring a witness in as a third party to represent it. You don't explicitly say, hey, you're the figure representing God here, but you bring it in to keep honesty between the two parties. So there is a representation of something higher. You're representing the whole community, and maybe not just the community of human to human, but human to God as well. Yeah. Okay, so second thing, and we'll get into this just a little bit today, and we'll come back on Wednesday and talk about it more, but it's the question of law. So law is a response. Now, there are all kinds of types of law. Leo's dad is one of the foremost experts in the world on natural law. Natural law already exists, right? So natural law, it's there when God creates. The natural law is inherent in all of creation. But the law I'm talking about now, it may be natural, but it's the law that God puts upon humanity so that humanity will behave itself. So this is where, and I know we talked a little bit about this last week, God could violate his own laws. I mean, he can break his own laws any time he wants, but because he's God. But he rarely, very, very, very rarely does, because he's true to his own nature. He's true to what he says. And what he says is not just, oh, at the moment, I have a frivolous whim. That's not God. Right? God is very deliberate and very ordered. So this is why a miracle can't really happen in nature. A miracle would be the suspension of nature, the suspension of the law or the natural law. But law itself is always given with covenant. And we have the greatest expression of law in what we call the Decalogue in the Ten Commandments. That is the most serious expression that we see of law coming down. But there's always, it's not the only one by any means. In fact, if you read Numbers, right, what is Numbers if not the law? This is always, you think about how many laws there are. There are over 600 dietary restrictions on Jews. Right? That, so these are, there are laws and then there are laws. Right? There's natural law and then the law that God puts upon us, which is a reflection of the natural law. Then there are kind of accidental laws. That is, laws that maybe come about by custom and so forth. So things that a local community might do. A group of, say, Irish Christians may worship in a different way than German Christians. The Presbyterians may worship differently than the Baptists. Those are local laws and customs as opposed to the law. So the law is something different. Thou shalt not have other gods before me. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not kill. At those laws. And I mentioned this just a little bit last week, but there's a logic to them. There's something when we say, do not murder. Yeah, that we probably could have figured that out on our own, but God makes it explicit. Right? So killing is different, self-defense, but murder, wanton murder, right? That's something quite different. So those things make sense when we read the Decalogue. But I also want you to keep in mind, going all the way back to about 45 minutes ago, remember, when Moses does get these from God, it's very sacred and it's very holy, and it's not like, Carly, as we were talking about earlier, it's not like Abraham, right? Moses does not laugh, right? That, you can't even imagine that happening in the way that Abraham did. So there's a much sterner relationship at this point. So it's also going to be very important when we get to Christianity, because of Christ as the law and the gospel, right? Well, Luther is very good about that, but we'll get into that later. So, okay, hand, I thought I saw. Yes, Laura.
Just that the three distinctions of law were the natural law.
For now, yes. Oh. Yeah, for now. We'll get into law a lot. But yes, so we saw the natural law in creation, but now we have the law of God, kind of explicit laws like covenantal laws that we see.
That's the law of God, that's how you're titling it?
Yes, it's direct, it's explicit, right? So the natural law is implicit. None of us is doubting that the sun will rise tomorrow. That's part of the natural law. It may not happen, but it would obviously be bizarre, and it would be against the natural law. We expect it to happen. But thou shalt not kill, we can probably figure that out, but it's good to have it explicit. Okay, last thing, guys, before you put your books up. The other thing I want you to keep in mind is what God says in Deuteronomy. And we can take this as a threat, but it's also logical. And that is what you read in Deuteronomy. When you follow the law, you will be blessed. And when you follow not the law, when you break it, you will be cursed. Now, we can take that literally, and I'm not suggesting that's not true. God either blesses you or he curses you, kind of. But we can also just say it's pretty clear that when we violate either the natural law or God's direct law, it creates confusion. There are very few victimless crimes. So it's very, we can say it's both direct, but it's also symbolic. That is, when we follow the law, things generally go well. It's not always true, right? Bad things happen. But generally, when we don't, usually things fall apart pretty quickly. All right, last comment, Shelby.
Would this be more like natural consequence of disobeying? Because obviously, yes. If you're murdering, like,
yes.
bad things will happen. Like, you're
absolutely.
Just going to have a worse life.
Yeah.
Is absolutely. That what it's talking about? Or is it talking about, like, specific
God smiting you? Like,
I think it could be both, and okay. It's been taken as, it's not really an either or, but a both and.
Okay.
Right? So it's both God can be very vengeful, okay. But also that when you do this thing, it just doesn't go right. Okay. Yeah, as a consequence. Both of those things, I think, okay. Are important. All right, thanks, everybody. So no new readings. We'll finish up with the Jews and start on the Greeks. And I'm going to talk a little bit about Greek history, so I'll lecture a little bit more. But have a good Monday and Tuesday.
Thank you, Dr. Berzer.
Thank you, guys.
I probably would have forgotten his name. I love this call.